Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the introduction to Cause, his book from Melville House, sociologist Gregory Smith-Simon cites the work of another sociologist about how we explain social facts with other social facts as a way of making sense of the world. Some of the examples he gives are quite familiar. Why did the recent recession occur? Because of housing speculation. Why did housing prices inflate in a bubble? Because mortgage funds were lent in risky ways. And those cause and effect explanations can go on ad infinitum. But Professor Smith-Simon argues this kind of reasoning often misleads both sociologists and the general public because it examines only one form of causality. Gregory Smith-Simon, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, joins us now. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
But didn't the 2008 recession occur largely because of housing speculation?
That's not untrue. But the reason I got interested in the topics that led me to write this book was that the work that I do involves a lot of interviews, and you know that process well. And it's really the process of people telling stories. And I got interested in the way that people tell stories and the way that they seek to explain things. In part because you find sometimes that those stories don't make any sense.
And you say we misunderstand causality because we're humans.
Yeah, it's very natural. And, you know, as sociologists, we think about the social world all the time. But really, it's something that dances with the physical world, with our biological reality. And so I wanted to understand how those things relate.
And you cite some other examples of this way of thinking that are a bit more iffy. 9/11 was a government conspiracy to push the U.S. into war with Iraq. America's segregated neighborhoods are the result of white and black preference. Changes in sex education curricula and the rate of condom usage led to the decline in teenage pregnancy. Do we pick and choose the explanations that best fit into our worldviews and confirm what we already believe?
We sure do, and it goes even farther than that. You know, there are certain types of explanations that work for us. Among those, as you say, are explanations that need to fit our pre-existing understandings. And often when there's a political story that doesn't fit, we just have a hard time, irrespective of what we want to dismiss, of making sense of that. And so I was sometimes getting stories when I was out in the field that I knew weren't actually true, but fit the kind of story somebody needed to tell themselves. Other times, honestly, you know, you would do an interview and you'd get an outright fabrication. So I needed to think about, you know, stories and reality and the relationship between them.
And you argue that the problem is that causal stories tend to oversimplify, moralize, ascribe blame, and identify heroes and villains.
And the funny thing is that we don't pay very much attention to how things actually happen. You know, when we as a society are facing a crisis, we're very concerned about it. When that crisis gets resolved, we spend astonishingly little time trying to figure out why it went away. You know, I'll ask people why the Vietnam War ended, and I rarely get a satisfying explanation. You mentioned teenage pregnancy, and I was in high school at the height of the teenage pregnancy crisis. We were all told that it was a crisis. Well, today, teen pregnancy rates are at a historic low, and I don't think anybody bothered to pay much attention to why that changed so dramatically.
But it isn't because of sex education?
You know, I would love it if it were, because
there was sex education when I went to high school, and that was a long, long time ago.
Well, and there are cities that introduced comprehensive sex education and saw pregnancy rates fall, and that's great. But then you have a state like Texas that had horribly inadequate sex education, closed women's health clinics, and still saw teen pregnancy rates fall. So the evidence doesn't bear out the single line story that we want to tell.
Can't our religious convictions also influence the way we interpret cause and effect? People become victims of natural disasters because they have engaged in sinful behavior.
There are all sorts of explanations like that, and I think that it's fascinating to look at the relationship between sort of predator and prey, victim and victor. Barbara Ehrenreich has a book that I've always loved called Blood Rights that talks about why people go to war. And, you know, we think of ourselves as, you know, in the gendered sense, man the hunter, when in fact evolutionarily we've spent most of our life, or most of our time evolutionarily as lunch. We've run away more often than we've run towards. And so we have this dual identification with predator and prey.
You say the very use of the word why becomes problematic.
It really feels like why is a human construct. You know, we're wired to ask the question why, we're wired to construct answers to why. But if you start picking apart any sort of a story, it's not so simple.
Your first chapter is headed, Individuals Are Not Rational. I hope you don't mean all the time.
I'm not even sure that individuals are individuals. You know, we are social animals, and we have this notion in our heads, it probably goes back to Robinson Crusoe, of the individual in the world. If you take someone and leave them alone in the world, that's called solitary confinement, and within hours it can have horrible effects on our psyche, our sense of ourselves. We don't exist alone.
And you actually do some literary analysis of Robinson Crusoe to explain all of this. So this book took you pretty far afield. You didn't just stick to a cause and effect.
That's the nice thing, honestly, about getting tenure, is that you can ask questions you don't have the answers to. And I want to put in a plug for giving academics the range to do that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm not a literary scholar, but when I wanted to think about the social sciences, I needed to think about economics, which means you think about rational actors, and they go back to Robinson Crusoe and a story about, you know, an individual on an island that is very misleading for us.
But part of the cause and effect also involves who wrote, the man who wrote Robinson Crusoe, Daniel Defoe. So you talk about what his life was like before he began writing. And he was involved in a rebellion. He could have gone to prison.
He could have been hung like hundreds of others were. He wasn't. And the story is that he modeled Robinson Crusoe after an individual who was stranded on an island. When that man was picked up, he made it clear to the captain who saved him that the challenge was not physical survival, but what he called the terror of being alone. There's another story of a man who was isolated, left on an island with a group of others, who Robinson Crusoe, who Daniel Defoe probably actually knew. And because that man's story involved being on an island with a whole bunch of people, that terror of being alone wasn't part of the real story, and it ended up not being part of Robinson Crusoe's fictional story.
Although he did bring Friday into the story and relieved Robinson Crusoe a bit. In that chapter called Individuals Are Not Rational, you explore the effects of solitude on people in all sorts of areas, truck drivers, pilots, suburban housewives, prisoners in isolation, and you say they all exhibit similar reactions to a lack of human contact, even for short periods of time.
And, you know, the Antarctic explorers knew that solitary confinement, thinking about Robinson Crusoe and Friday, can happen even with two people, that two people alone can suffer the same sort of destabilizing situation. And that brought me actually to Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique. She talked in the 1950s and 60s about suburban housewives who suffered from what she called the problem that has no name. And we can point to a lot of problems that women in that position experienced. You know, the frustration of being unable to participate in the workforce, the dissatisfaction with their marriages. But in a significant measure, it's clear that those women were telling her they were unhappy in the suburbs where they were alone.
But it seems to have kind of really extreme We have extreme responses. You cite abnormal brain activity, hypersensitivity to stimuli, hallucinations, anger, paranoia, mood swings. Just because, so truck drivers are facing that sort of thing when they're on the road for a long haul?
It's frightening. You were reading from the descriptions of prisoners in solitary confinement and what they experienced. Truck drivers on the long haul will describe seeing things on the roadway that aren't there. And when you listen to Friedan's quotes of housewives with their young infant children out in the suburbs in the 1950s with no car, stranded in those subdivisions, they're describing the same thing: depression, mood swings, anger, lack of motivation. They're describing out in these idyllic suburbs the emotional experiences of solitary confinement.
You also say that despite the value Americans place on individuality and rationality, we are fundamentally social beings and create and understand the world from a social perspective.
We really do. There's not much possibility of us being alone. I would say that, you know, commuting to work in a car for half an hour requires a car radio or something to listen to. And in the same way, there's very little that we know as individuals. The things that you're certain are true, almost without exception, are things that the people around you agree are true as well. It's hard to hold a belief in isolation.
I've always wondered why some people are more empathetic and less judgmental than others.
That's a good question, but I think it speaks to the way that we are connected to other people, and whether you judge people harshly or sympathetically, it's about your relationship to their story. Do you want to argue with the story that they're telling or engage with the story that they're telling?
Is this something that comes from just the way you were brought up? Your parents were really always interested in other people's stories, where other parents were dismissive all the time?
That's a good question.
The same reason that we often wind up in the same political party that our parents were in?
I imagine that it may even go beyond political party in that, I sometimes think about researchers like myself being interested in understanding, say, a story or root causes, and people who are attracted to getting into electoral politics being interested in the dynamic process of making something happen, right? Understanding the problem or being part of what's changing the problem. And, you know, in terms of understanding, I think we can think about our need for confessions, right? The way that we're relieved when somebody admits that what we think is true is true. We may know something for a certainty, but from the Spanish Inquisition to the torture in Iraq, we need to hear people tell us what we know, or it drives us crazy.
We wind up with false confessions as well. It's always confusing to somebody who has not been put through that experience why somebody, after an awful lot of interrogation, would finally admit to a crime that he or she didn't commit.
You know, it's even more hard to understand is, you know, we've seen the effect that long interrogation takes, and the gold standard, as the criminal justice reform folks point out, the gold standard of the signed first-person confession is almost meaningless. You can get them out of all sorts of people for things they didn't do. But what's even more remarkable is our need for those confessions. If you think about examples in history of show trials where people were tortured into confessing, if there's going to be a show trial, an imprisonment or execution, why do you care whether the person you're planning to punish says to you, oh, you're right, you know, I was a counter-revolutionary, I was a spy, I was an agent of a foreign government. Their fate is already sealed, but
we need it in writing?
We need that admission, even though we're extorting it through torture that we know means they'll say anything. It's a peculiar feature of human thinking.
You call your approach dynamic causality as opposed to what you call egocentric causality. Can you explain?
Sure. Egocentric causality is something that I came upon when I was listening to people tell stories. And, you see this, for instance, when white families will talk about how their neighborhood went from all white to all black. Realtors from the 1950s and 60s would tell these stories. And there was one great example where one of the realtors said, well, you know, it starts when the Negroes, as he called them at the time, start showing up. They'll walk down the street for no reason. They'll occasionally shop in the stores. They'll use the playgrounds on a limited basis once in a while. And this,
like everyone else.
Exactly. This realtor could only imagine that driving down the street, walking down the street and using the playgrounds was some malicious plot. Egocentric causality is the idea that he was afraid, so he imagined that the people must be doing it to make him afraid. Egocentric causality is when you think that the effect on you is the cause that was intended.
Such as, they did it just to annoy me.
Yeah, that's the classic, right? You know, if your ex brings a date to a party and you say, oh, they did it just to ignore me. Odds are they brought the date because they wanted to spend the night with the date and they didn't care about you. But that's not the way that most people are going to explain that.
You seem to be particularly interested in the stories that people tell that are not true. But because they have been told so often and for so long, they tend to be regarded as the truth.
And sometimes they're politically convenient. You know, this came from, again, fieldwork I was doing. I was down in the neighborhoods around the World Trade Center and interviewed a guy who was a real prominent figure in the neighborhood. He always had his rescue dog with him and a rescue T-shirt on. And he told me this moving story about how his dog had recovered more people from the World Trade Center than anybody else. And in my dissertation, I put a little footnote in and I said, you know, there was almost no one alive taken out of the World Trade Center. I assume he was talking about bodies. It didn't matter. I didn't follow up. And I'm glad that I put that little caveat in there because he later went to federal prison for lying. He told me he moved to the neighborhood after September 11th. He told the federal authorities he had moved there beforehand in order to get rent benefits. And it made me think about what I was going to do with these stories that people were telling me and how to think about their truth value, their trustworthiness.
Why are some completely outlandish conspiracy theories believed by millions of Americans? I guess millions of people all over the world.
Yeah, you know, and we all do. I think in some ways it's an engineering problem. You can take a situation and see
what... A pizzeria that's involved with pedophilia, and somebody takes it so seriously, he goes in to the pizzeria and shoots the place up.
It fits, right? And I'll give an example that, you know, we all probably hold a couple of these. Think about political assassinations. I would suggest that most of the time, most of the ones that we can think of are along the lines of Gabrielle Giffords being shot by Jared Lee Lochner, a disturbed person who has a real uncontrolled anger across the political spectrum, right? Lochner was furious at Giffords, who was a Democrat. He also had rants against Bush, who was a Republican when he was president at the time. We get that. Rewind to Ronald Reagan, and we think the same thing. John Hinckley was disturbed. Rewind to JFK. Lee Harvey Oswald was someone who danced across the political line from the Marines to the Russians to the pro-Cuba to the anti-Cuba side. He was an angry young man. I would say the thing that's even more remarkable is that if you roll the calendar back to Abraham Lincoln, an assassination that we think of as so politically significant, marking the South's resentment against this Northern president who had just won the Civil War. When you read the angry rantings of John Wilkes Booth, and you consider that that assassination could have been carried out with someone who is simply as disturbed as Jared Lee Lochner, it forces us to think about politics in a different way.
And yet, recently had a guest on the show, a respected academic, teaches one of the best New York universities, who's convinced that that JFK was killed as a result of some government conspiracy.
And, you know, I'll admit that the devil is in the details, which is to say not every assassination is the same. But when you look at, you know, when Oswald was assassinated, it had been nearly 100 years since a president had been killed. And I think it was shocking to people. And we were looking for an explanatory story that made sense. And people have been scrambling for that. You know, after President Ford was shot, after President Reagan was shot, after Giffords was shot, after a series of assassinations of, you know, Robert Kennedy and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, you start to see a pattern in these assassinations of young men between 23 and 26 who are disturbed and angry. And it's a little bit easier, right, in the sort of Occam's razor suggestion that the simplest explanation is normally the best, to think that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting much in the same way that all those other young men were acting.
I'm speaking to sociologist Gregory Smith-Simon, whose book Cause has just been re-released now in paperback from Melville House. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Well, then you have other kinds of explanations for shootings. For example, the man who shot up the Pittsburgh synagogue said all Jews must die.
It's true. That's not so far from what I was saying, though, right? Clearly a disturbed man with deranged ideas. Very far from the idea we have about JFK that it was a carefully constructed plot, or of Lincoln where the assassination represented, you know, a larger political movement. It's an individual.
And I wondered whether he meant all Jews, Ashkenazic Jews, Sephardic Jews, people who'd converted to Judaism, people African-American Jews. We could go on and on and on. Is there something, it was just the fact that they had that religion or born into that religion?
You know, one of the things that's curious to me about that is that we're the New World, right? We're in North America. We, like Latin America, are a combination of American, Asian, African, and European roots. And somehow we imported European anti-Semitism into the U.S. Europe has had a history of anti-Semitism for literally 1,000 years.
Really pushed it hard.
Yeah, and you know, kings and states for centuries have issued anti-Semitic decrees and have used Jews as scapegoats. How that particular type of hate showed up here on these shores is an odd cultural inheritance that, you know, I think we all wish we had, you know, that immigrants had left in the home country.
President didn't condemn the people who said the Jews will not replace us. So, but anyway, how important is the role of the internet in spreading these kinds of stories? People blame the social media for so many things these days.
That's true. It certainly changes the way that things get communicated, but I'm not sure that it changes the types of stories we tell. Right? Our ability to spread them is different. I'm also curious about the way that it changes those social connections. You know, what's interesting to me about the internet is that it's one of these technologies that we adapt. It becomes part of our lives, and we quickly can't imagine what life was like before that, in the same way that, you know, think about the arrival of the telephone, right? Before the telephone, for all of human history, once someone walked out of earshot, you couldn't hear their voice anymore. That must have been a tremendous shift in your perception of the world, on par with the arrival of the internet, but we don't think about that moment anymore.
Well, in the past, you either had to read about it in a book or an article. You had to have a conversation about it. And now it just plops right into your computer.
It's true. You can find things all sorts of places. And it also means you can connect with people. I have this discussion with my students all the time when they're out in the world doing field work and they go into a Burger King or a Starbucks and there are four students sitting in a booth and they all know each other and they're all on their phones. I asked them, so if the four students didn't have their phones and were talking to each other, are they more connected or less connected than the four who are sitting there on their phones? And some students will say, well, it would be better if they were paying more attention. But a large number of them say, no, in fact, they're more connected on their phones because the old-fashioned situation is a conversation among four people. With everybody's phones in their hand, it may be a conversation among 40. That's not the way that I would have seen it, but they make an interesting case and are... social network is different in that way, in a way that we're not returning to.
It's been suggested that Russian hackers had a major impact on the last presidential election because of things that they spread on the internet through social media.
That there certainly seems to be evidence that they made those efforts.
Is that a cause and effect situation?
It is. I would suggest, and I'm sure that WBAI listeners will not be surprised to hear me say that, you know, the American government knows plenty about interfering with elections even before the days of the internet. The technology may be new, but the impulse and the practice is certainly
right.
Not.
Latin Americans specifically. And of course, we could always invoke the Monroe Doctrine as an excuse.
Sure. I'm sure that Putin would be happy to name a doctrine after somebody to justify his actions as well.
You give the way people respond to the diabetes epidemic as an example. Since weight gain greatly increases a person's chances of developing diabetes, You say still egotistical causality blames the victim for lacking self-control. Well, shouldn't people try to eat better and exercise?
Sure they do. Diabetes runs all through my family, and I try to do exactly that. At the same time, I've done a good amount of research on diabetes, both with patients and with doctors. And what you see, by and large, is people having a very hard time controlling diabetes and doctors not being successful. I'd suggest this is an example of a place where doctors could practice better medicine if they brought in a little sociology.
Instead, what we have, again, going back to the internet, is body shaming.
That's right. And, you know, we also have a sort of failure to understand how people work. You know, imagine the difficulty of changing your diet. You have a doctor's appointment on Wednesday morning. He says you've got diabetes. change everything you eat. Well, if, for instance, you're a Chicano family in Texas and the food you eat is part of your identity, it's sort of like the doctor saying, so you have diabetes, stop being Latino.
So what would the dynamic causality response be?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think that the approach can contribute. I did a lot of interviews with people on that question of food and found that when they could change the way they were eating in a fashion that made them feel like they were being more culturally authentic rather than less, it stuck. And people would often find that their grandmother who had emigrated from their home country cooked very differently than they did, that in fact what they're imagining as authentic food from Mexico or Barbados had been Americanized in a big way. So that's a little change, a sort of culturally sensitive change you can make. But there's a larger social question about why the rate of diabetes took off in the 1980s that is not easily explained by the conventional sort of medical picture of, you know, us needing diet and exercise.
If it's partly due to economic and nutritional insecurity, would that mean that diabetes tends to hit poor people more?
It absolutely does. And what we see is that the diabetes rate in the U.S. took off in the early 1980s as the social safety net that was, you know, as good as we had been able to assemble started getting cut in the Reagan era. And what you see indications of in a lot of different settings is that a sense of security about your future leaves you in better health. And, you know, I think most of us can relate to this. When you're worried about your finances, your future, where your next meal is coming from, you eat the food you can get your hands on, and your body knows that. You act like a squirrel in the fall. Winter is coming, put on the pounds. If you do that for too long, you've got a health problem.
In fact, you cite the evolutionary factors here, behavioral adaptation, which has enabled some so-called primitive peoples to store energy before periods of scarcity.
Sure, that is wired into us, and I think it's not coincidental that you see that in societies with a stronger social safety net, where people think that their housing, their food, and their future is relatively secure, you tend to have lower obesity rates. And then in a country like the U.S., where we roll the dice about whether our boss will fire us tomorrow every morning, and there's no safety net and there are no assurances, we worry. And as that worry grows, so does our waistline.
Maybe that's why we're seeing so many commercials these days on television for diabetes drugs. You cite the medical allostasis model. What's that?
Yeah, so this was fascinating. I came upon it because I was doing a lot of work on diabetes and was having a hard time explaining the diabetes epidemic with the conventional homeostatic model, the sort of conventional medical model, which imagines, I think of it as a sort of classic model, the sort of Newtonian physics model of the world, where your body wants to be at a certain set point, a certain weight, a certain pulse, a certain temperature, and so it wants to be at 98.6 degrees. If you get hot, you sweat. If you get cold, you shiver, and it brings you back to that fixed set point temperature. That works for some examples. Allostasis points out that if you face something that's stressful or dangerous, your blood pressure may shoot up. You'll address that tiger lurking in the bush. You'll get away, your blood pressure goes down again. If the threat is short and acute, it goes up and your blood pressure goes up and down. If you're living in a society that makes you anxious all the time, at a certain point, your body predicts that stressful situation is the new normal. And Peter Sterling used the term allostasis to describe this predictive response. It, I would suggest, may be why high blood pressure is not only epidemic in the United States, but something like 95% of the cases are ones that doctors can't explain and have a hard time controlling, because as you take pills to lower your blood pressure, your body wants to get up to that new high level. You're fighting against its own impulses.
You say that you've written this book, Cause, as a self-help book for making each of us a better political citizen.
Well, I think...
How is talking about diabetes and some of the other things you discuss here, political?
I think that, you know, all of the topics I talk about are ones that we need to make, decisions as a society about how we're going to address. And as a sociologist, I know that sociology has a lot of tools and a lot of observations and findings that don't get out to the general public. There are fields like economics and behavioral sociology that do a great job of writing popular books and getting their ideas out in the world. And I honestly think that sociology has a lot to add in understanding things like race, terrorism, and politics that, you know, in those urgent moments of collective fear, we could contribute and make a difference with.
You're a professor, and you say one of the ways sociology is useful to students is that it makes them better at evaluating information. So the problem is we get all this information, if we don't know how to evaluate it, it just simply reinforces our own prejudices?
And that's certainly not going to get easier as the information that we have access to comes flowing to us in more and more online venues. It's not only about, for instance, looking at sources, but testing what we see against our assumptions. You know, if information reinforces our pre-existing notions, we want to be careful of that. We want to know who's writing it and where it comes from. You know, these are things that I work with my students with on constantly. I've been teaching long enough that it used to be that students were not getting their information off the internet, and at least they knew where it was coming from. Students today, you know, point, click, and read before they even know what the source is. And that's, I think, one of the first challenges in helping them think about how to validate or test the information that's coming across their phones.
I'm speaking with Gregory Smith-Simon, whose book, Cause, and How It Doesn't Always Equal Effect, is now available in paperback from Melville House. How does the current debate over climate change apply to what we're discussing?
You know, climate change is an interesting one because I think that, you know, those of us that recognize that climate change is real and that climate change is happening think that we've done the work we need to do to understand the situation. And I think that there's quite a bit we could do to grasp it a little bit better. I admit that I'm somebody who is sympathetic. You know, scientists call this the Anthropocene era, the period when humans are having an effect on the climate. And there are folks who argue that we should call it the Capitalocene because it's capitalism that does it. I understand where that impulse comes from, but I'm not sure that if we didn't have the current type of industrial capitalism that we do, that we wouldn't be staying warm and saving effort by burning fossil fuels. So there are problems that we're going to be facing, and I think that looking at things with a dynamic causality lens means we might look a little bit differently, particularly at the question of mitigation versus adaptation.
I was thinking about now-retired Representative Lamar Smith of Texas, who led the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology for 6 years. He did everything possible he harassed federal climate scientists, dismissed the threat of climate change. He stacked hearings with industry lobbyists and like-minded skeptics. And one of the things he claimed was that pumping Earth's atmosphere full of carbon dioxide is beneficial to crop production and overall planetary lushness. So that's his cause and effect explanation.
You know, the hubris in all of the suggestions that we can go playing with the climate is astonishing to me. Even folks who say, well, you know, technology will fix this some way. To be playing with the environment and the air that we breathe is sort of amazing. And if you think about the way that we've lost snow caps, right? The amount of uninterrupted winters we would need to rebuild those would be devastating to our food production. What I mean is that...
In other words, they're denying reality, not just the melting snow caps of the Arctic, but also displaced communities. Polar bears have been recently entering homes in Siberia because it's too... Because they don't have a comfortable climate to live in.
Well, and I'll say that it imagines that that the carbon dioxide levels or the temperature of the atmosphere, that there's a sliding switch somewhere, like on a control board, that we can raise and lower. We have affected the climate, but we can't easily tweak it to the exact spot we want. And that's one of the reasons that I think that while certainly we want to reduce the effect of climate change, the degree to which temperatures will continue to warm, which they will, it's probably worth focusing on adaptation to a significant degree and thinking about it a little bit differently.
It's been pointed out that the climate change deniers don't make a distinction between weather and climate, which allows them to use a snowstorm as a way of saying that there's no global warming after all. Does the climate change debate derive from asking the why rather than the how?
It does, and it goes even farther than that. You know, some folks will look at that sort of climate change denial and say, you know, what we need to do is get away from the why question. Let's not ask why climate is changing, because it is. Let's engage climate change deniers on adaptation, in other words, in responding to climate change. And there's a saying that adaptation is agnostic. And the idea is that we would have to argue over the science of why the temperatures in the seas are rising, but that we could all agree that we need to, say, protect against hurricanes. I think that's not actually true.
You said that we can't just blame capitalism, but are capitalism and industrialism to blame to some degree for climate change because it's in the best economic interests of many powerful people and companies for us to continue to rely on fossil fuels?
Sure it is, but the UN report suggests that if we stopped burning all fossil fuels by lunchtime tomorrow, that the temperatures would rise and the seas would rise for a century or two more. So we're locked into these changes. Yeah, there's no going back.
Because it's already up there?
Exactly. That sea level rise is not going to go away. I think when you talk about the politics of it, what's interesting to me is that people say, so therefore we need to talk about what to do. That won't be political. And I think that that's actually where we get it exactly wrong. It's not that the conservatives don't want to do anything in response to climate change. I would argue that the border wall is Trump's climate change policy. He has a climate change policy. There are climate refugees. He's going to build a wall and keep us out. So to be honest,
keep the climate in this country a little whiter than it might be otherwise.
and so rather than reaching across the aisle and working with someone like that on climate change policy, I hope he does deny it's going on and leaves the work to people who think about the politics of, you know, whether we're going to respond in a way that raises everybody's boat as the seas rise or let some sink and let some swim, which I think would be his approach.
You present three cause and effect explanations for the persistence of racial segregation in the United States. Should I cite them or do you want to do it?
Please.
One, blacks and whites self-segregate because each group prefers to live with its own kind. Two, government and business policies and practices such as racially motivated lending restrictions keep blacks out of white majority neighborhoods. And three, black Americans choose to live in black majority neighborhoods because they feel white neighborhoods aren't safe. Isn't there truth, some truth anyway, in all of that?
There is. The idea, and I get this from my students all the time, they'll say, well, you know, don't people prefer to live with their own kind? And it's very attractive, and it sort of naturalizes the situation.
I've never felt that need.
No, but, you know, when you look at the surveys, people do want to live in certain types of neighborhoods they don't get to. So, for instance, African Americans typically say that they want to live in a neighborhood that's 50-50. White Americans say that they want to live in a neighborhood that's 10% black. Actually, neither group gets to do that because what happens is that as a neighborhood becomes 10% black, white Americans say, well, that's enough, no more. And African Americans say, well, that's a good start. And before you know it, a neighborhood that had been all white, nowadays over the course of maybe 30 or 40 years, becomes overwhelmingly African American, and we resegregate these neighborhoods.
But don't we self-segregate in other ways? For example, we might want to live in a certain area because the local church or synagogue is nearby, so we see areas where people, most of the people are of a certain religion, not necessarily race. Rich people tend to live together. They choose to live together. Poor people may not choose to live in those neighborhoods or in NYCHA housing, but they have no choice. There are all sorts of other kinds of segregations.
There are. You know, I think that one thing to think about is the fact that African Americans don't get the same sorts of choices. And so, you know, as white Americans, I think plenty of people look at black neighborhoods and think, all right, you know, center city black neighborhoods have higher proportions of poor people. The segregated schools have fewer resources. The crime rate may be higher. Why would anyone want to live there? And I think it's telling that if you think about it, for many African Americans, as dangerous as white America might think a black neighborhood is, black Americans think a white neighborhood is more dangerous.
Oh, and you could get shot just walking down the street.
In the work that I did in the suburbs of Baltimore, there's a large African-American suburb, about 80,000 middle-class African-Americans live there.
You're writing a book called Liberty Road.
That's right.
On that. You come out of that area, don't you, suburbs out of Baltimore? You said you left the suburbs when you were 18 because they were boring, and then came back 18 years later to discover because they're fascinating.
They are fascinating. You know, if you think about the black American experience, the 19th century black experience was rural. The 20th century black experience was urban. the 21st century black experience is likely to be suburban. 40% of black Americans today live in the suburbs. And I don't think that very many of us have a notion of what an authentic black experience or what a black American suburban experience would be. So it seemed like there was a gap there that we hadn't looked at, and I wanted to understand that.
It's been pointed out that you don't address the gun debate in this book, but have you thought about the causal explanations that were invoked after all of the mass shootings that have taken place in the U.S. in recent years?
Well, I think that other people have done a good job of it. And, you know, it's interesting to look at the singular American resistance to gun control, like our resistance, say, to universal health care, right? We sort of stand alone in a few areas like that. I think that people have a pretty good grasp of it. You know, one thing to think about is the idea that Americans who defend gun ownership want to defend themselves. And it's worth asking who, you know, who is that imaginary person they imagine climbing in the window? And I think it comes honestly from our history of as a colonizing state, you know, as a place that knew that there were a bunch of people that might have justified resentments against some of the Americans who were benefiting from that. We need to get past that mind frame.
Some of the explanations I've seen, the shooter is a product of godlessness in American culture. The FBI failed to follow clues. An on-duty deputy refused to act. The shootings didn't really happen, but were faked by gun control advocates using actors.
Well, and that conspiracy theory mindset about the fake shootings goes back to what I was saying about how it's hard for us to accept things that don't fit our preconceived notions. And so if you don't want to believe that guns are dangerous, which is a strange sentence to say, incidents where that seems to be the case are going to be ones that you dismiss. We all do that. I think that you know, there are a small number of people with those conspiracy theories who have a harder time than most Americans in recognizing that those things happen.
Your field, sociology, covers race, class, gender identity, sexuality, ability. But you say, I'm quoting, sociology as a field hasn't really done a good job of taking all the stuff that we know and presenting it to the mainstream in a way that contributes to public debates. Why has it failed?
I honestly don't know, because for me, sociology is the most fascinating discipline. I mean, the things that you just listed are at the core of, you know, almost any of the big political arguments that we have. And sociologists do research in areas that can really contribute, you know, have understandings of race, of class, of economic inequality, of sexuality and gender that can really inform our popular discussions. You know, we're not a field that has done a good job of writing engaging popular books, but I really think we can. There's terrific information there, and I hope that this book is a first step.
You're a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Should I assume that your students are most likely to subscribe to liberal cause and effect answers?
You know, I think my students are from Brooklyn, which is a vast and diverse borough. You know, it's fascinating to teach those students because in some ways, sure, that's true. You know, they're almost all immigrants and the children of immigrants. They're from a largely working class borough, although there's diversity there. So on the one hand, they understand things like race, immigration, and class, and how hard it is to make a living in Brooklyn, in New York City, no matter how hard you try. On the other hand, you know, it's funny, living in Brooklyn, there are things that they are sometimes less likely to see. Their experience of high school is that everybody's from somewhere. And so the idea that there is anti-immigrant sentiment is actually something that is, I'll say, further from their everyday experience than if you were teaching students who are in a wider, more homogenous part of the country. Brooklyn is a different experience.
Well, are things changing as Brooklyn becomes more and more expensive for a place to live? People are being priced out of what in the past was considered affordable housing?
You know, Brooklyn College is geographically dead center in the heart of Brooklyn, and it's a fantastic experience.
But it's the end of the line if you're taking the subway.
Which means that half of Brooklyn doesn't get served by those subways. But the perspective you get sitting in the middle of Brooklyn is that while housing is expensive for everyone in New York, and has been for 30 or 40 years, and wasn't before and doesn't need to be, the gentrification that we're talking about, though it's chronic in neighborhoods, and the cost of housing is high even in neighborhoods that are not gentrifying, that brownstone Brooklyn you know, my brownstone Brooklyn friends see as the whole borough, is a thin crust along the edge of Brooklyn that's along Manhattan, that the borough is much vaster, more diverse and more interesting than you'd get an impression of if you were just in Park Slope.
gentrification has led to integration of Bed-Stuyvesant, for example. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because people are being pushed out of their homes or selling them because houses that were worth very little in the past now can go for $1 million.
You know, this has been an active debate for a number of years among urban sociologists. Is segregation decreasing? And there are a couple of reasons to think it might. Gentrification would lead to whites often moving into non-white neighborhoods. Immigration means that members of other ethnic groups are moving into neighborhoods that were once more homogenous. By the numbers, you see that those sorts of processes happening in a bunch of different neighborhoods. Qualitatively, when my students go out into the field, the question that they often ask is, does this actually lead to interaction? And the answers that I get from students who occupy both sides of that gentrification process, some of them are the gentrifiers and some of them are the gentrified, is that there's very little interaction across that divide. And I think that means that even when a neighborhood on the map by the census numbers looks like it's getting less segregated, it doesn't mean that we have fulfilled our ambition of creating an integrated city or a mixed neighborhood.
You've published several books, one of them, September 12th, Community and Neighborhood Recovery at Ground Zero. Now, that is a very different kind of a neighborhood, but one that continues to be controversial because, well, among other things, people who live there are getting sick.
Yeah, you know, it was a fascinating neighborhood for a lot of reasons. And, you know, I'm beginning a project now looking at neighborhoods that are facing the risk of displacement because of climate change. And looking at Battery Park City after September 11th was a good way to start with that. In a number of ways, one, the real risks that residents face, the health risks, the displacement from their homes, the fear of living in a neighborhood that was at risk. On the other hand, that neighborhood could be a best case model in the sense that if you look at the response from the government to the displacement in Lower Manhattan after September 11th, you know, residents got substantial rent subsidies for a couple of years. Because local and federal authorities didn't want those neighborhoods to get depopulated. Think back to the poor neighborhoods in Brooklyn and the South Bronx in the 1970s and 80s that were depopulated, and the fact that the city didn't have enough money to board up the windows of abandoned buildings. Mm. So when I think about displacement, if you compare the thousands of dollars per residence that they got to their benefit in Battery Park City and compare it to the completely inadequate response in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, it makes you think about Battery Park City as perhaps a reference that we should use when thinking about what to do for all kinds of neighborhoods, not just wealthy neighborhoods near the financial center, when disaster strikes.
But the South Bronx has bounced back to some degree. It just took a while.
It has, and you know, that story is really a story about immigration, right? New York has always been populated by immigrants, and when we closed off the taps in the late 1920s to 1965, you didn't have new people coming into the city. It hasn't been really the yuppies and bankers that have repopulated those neighborhoods, but immigrants. It's one of those ways that one policy can have an unexpected effect on another.
Just one more thing. You've said your approach has been inspired in part by Ben Lerner, a CUNY distinguished professor of English at Brooklyn College. Isn't he a poet? What does that have to do with sociology?
He is, and I have to admit as a social scientist that it was his poetry that moved me. I happened to be on his tenure committee because I got to campus a little bit before him, and I was reading his tenure file, and he said that while he's known for his novels, he considered himself first and foremost a poet. So I dropped his file and I picked up his books of poetry and took what may have been my first crack at really reading poetry. Social scientists are not the most lyrical people by and large. And for me, what was fantastic about it was that social sciences like sociology have a bunch of tools to understand the world, and we can measure them, we can quantify them, we can qualify them, we can verify them. And you know, I like the fact that we are a positivist scientist that can know science, that can know things. What Lerner's poetry suggested to me is that there are things that are true, these sort of gossamer threads that hold us together, that relate one person to another, that sociology traditionally doesn't have the fine-toothed tools to appreciate. And so this book was in part an effort to think about some of those subtle influences that have such an influence on everyday life that a poet can capture, but that perhaps sociology has been unattuned to. So I really appreciate him sort of making me aware of the fact that there were realities that we weren't looking at, and that maybe a book like Cause could help us think about them in a social scientific way.
Gregory Smith-Simon is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, the author of a number of books, also an editor of the online journal Metropolitics. He has written for The Village Voice, Dissent, In These Times, and The Wall Street Journal Online. And the book we've been discussing is Cause and How It Doesn't Always Equal Effect, now available in paperback from Melville House Publishing. Thank you so much for being on our show. It's been really fascinating.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Gregory Smith-Simon, to Jesse Lent, who is my engineer, and as well as my executive producer today, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music. Leonard Lopez at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.